Welcome to the Impact 360 Institute podcast, where our goal is to explore biblical worldview and servant leadership to equip you for everyday influence. Here's your host, author and director of cultural engagement, Jonathan Morrow.
Welcome to the Impact 360 Institute podcast. My guest today is author of the book Undeniable, Dr. Douglas Axe, and he is the director of Biologic Institute. His research uses both experiments and computer simulations to examine the functional and structural constraints on the evolution of proteins and protein systems. After a Caltech PhD, he held postdoctoral and research scientist positions at the University of Cambridge, the Cambridge Medical Research Council Center, and the Barbraham Institute in Cambridge. His work and ideas have been featured in many scientific journals, including the Journal of Molecular Biology, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and Nature, and in such books as Signature in the Cell and Darwin's Doubt by Stephen Meyer and Life Solution by Simon Conway Morris. So he's been working in these areas for over 25 years, so really, really privileged to have Dr. Doug Axe with us to talk about his new book, Undeniable. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Great. Well, why did you decide to write the book, Undeniable, and who's it for?
Good question. I spent a little over 25 years as a Christian and a scientist doing work to test whether Darwin's account of life could be true or not. And by the end of it, I was convinced that it is not true, that we cannot be accidents, that an intelligent designer, God, had to have made us. I had an opportunity with HarperCollins to write a book, and I was thinking about the best way to write it. And one option would have been to take all this technical work that was done over those 25 years and translate it into everyday English and try to give a simplified version of that. I wasn't very happy with that option, though, because it feels to me as though if I do that, then there are other qualified people, scientists, who will say that I misrepresented something or I forgot to tell the reader about this and that. And so I've become experienced with the way this tends to become a to-ing and fro-ing, like a tennis match. And your average person who doesn't have a PhD, isn't a scientist, doesn't know who to believe, but you can pick your side and root for one side or the other. I'm fundamentally convinced that this is not a technical issue. The question of where we came from is not technical fundamentally. It comes down to common science and our intuition on this that we all have, that we were made by a godlike designer, whether you're an atheist or a Christian or anything else. We all have that intuition early on. And so in the book, I decided to leverage that intuition and to show that our common sense reasoning on this is actually correct.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. You used the term there, common science. Kind of, what do you mean by common science?
Well, so I'm making a play on common sense. Common sense is the kind of reasoning that you don't sit down and write out logic. It's not a formal logic. It's just things that are obvious, but they are often correct. Common sense is typically correct. Common science, it's just an extension of that where we're connecting our obvious form of reasoning with everyday experience. And so I argue in the book that we're all really scientists, if you include common science as part of science. We all observe the world. We're all making mental models of how things work. A two-year-old is experimenting with gravity, you know, just as Isaac Newton was experimenting with gravity, a simpler, more everyday version. But the two-year-old forms a model of how things work, knows what's going to happen with a ball if you let go of it, and knows what's going to happen if he, you know, or she trips over a step trying to learn how to walk or to run. So it's not just gravity. It's everything in the real world that we encounter. We make these models of how these things work so that we can work with them, and we refine those models as and when experience requires them to be refined. So that's a scientific undertaking. I aim to do in the book is leverage that kind of science, which I call common science, and show that simple kind of science that we're all experts in shows that we cannot be cosmic accidents. We have to have been designed. We were made by God.
I think that's a powerful way to get at that for sure. What kind of pushback have you? I'm just curious on that. Like, have you received kind of the counter-argument that, well, look, I mean, you know, when we're kids, a lot of things seem obvious to us, but we tend to outgrow those kinds of things. So how would you kind of interact with somebody who kind of made that kind of counter-argument?
Sure, and I would stress that in the book, although I start with that intuition, the intuition itself is not an argument. And I say in the book, not all intuitions are correct, and certainly not all ideas that we had when we were two or three or four are correct. A lot of those ideas get removed or replaced with more correct ideas as we learn and we grow. This one, though, I say is correct. But I'm not simply saying it's an intuition, therefore it's correct. I show why it has to be so. And so there's a distinction between common science, part of the book, and the intuition itself. The intuition is interesting because it's been acknowledged by people who work in psychology that everyone has this. It doesn't matter what your upbringing is. If your parents are atheists and raising you as an atheist, still at the age of four, you looked at butterflies and thought of them as having been designed by a godlike designer. And this is widely acknowledged. Now, the people who are acknowledging it think that it's a wrong intuition and that it needs to be replaced. But it's interesting that we all have it. That's just a starting point for the book. Then there's an argument, the simple argument that shows that particular intuition that life is designed turns out to be correct.
No, yeah, I completely agree. I think that's an excellent way to get at it. So you've kind of really kind of teased out this idea of the universal design intuition and kind of coined that. But as far as the other side of the equation, as far as people who wouldn't share this design, is probably the Darwinian story. Where do you think Charles Darwin kind of went wrong, and maybe even define some terms for some people, like what is neo-Darwinism and some things like that, just to help orient
sure.
the conversation?
So Darwin's big book on the origin of species came out in 1859, and his sort of claim to fame was a clear and extended argument based on natural selection, and he really coined the term natural selection, drawing an analogy to artificial or human selection, and looking in particular at plant and animal breeding. The way we breed dogs, we can get a chihuahua to look like a chihuahua and a Doberman to look like a Doberman. And he argued that nature does the similar sort of thing with natural species and the variations in them, and in fact ended up making dogs and cats and, you know, palm trees and all of these things. So by analogy, he argued that nature does the same sort of thing that human breeders do, and because it's been doing it for a much longer period of time, it can accomplish much more remarkable changes than human breeders can. He had no idea what genes were, because nobody did at the time. His hypothesis was that something is transmitted from parents to children, to offspring, that carries sort of a picture of the parent and allows the offspring, it makes the offspring resemble the parents. And it wasn't until later, much later in the 20th century, that the idea that DNA, that genetic material, was this substance of heredity, was connected to Darwin's thinking. So in the mid-1900s, starting in the 1920s or so, there started to be a mathematical framework that was built around Darwinism and then connecting to the idea of DNA being the genetic material, it really gave a boost to the whole evolutionary theory, and that's what's referred to as the modern synthesis or neo-Darwinism. So to this day, if you're reading a textbook, if you're studying biology, doing AP biology, you will be taught basically the neo-Darwinian model of evolution, that we all came about through mistakes in DNA replication that were selected by natural selection.
Well, my guest today, I'm talking to Dr. Douglas Axe. He's the author of the new book, Undeniable, How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life is Designed. So we're talking a little bit about Darwinian evolution here. We're talking about the universal design intuition. I love the book, by the way, and there's some great illustrations in there that I think help people kind of get some mental hooks, if you will, on some of these things. So you talk about Oracle Soup a little bit. You want to kind of share how you use that as an illustration?
Well, I use it, I say this, it looks just like alphabet soup. It's got the pasta numbers and letters swirling around, but this is a special kind of soup that's been discovered, and I describe what it does by giving a simple recipe for using it. You take a large pot of this soup that looks like alphabet soup, you put the lid on, you bring it to a boil, you let it cool, take the lid off, and on the surface of the soup, it's spelled out in these pasta characters, detailed instructions for making some functional device, so detailed that it would be worthy of a patent. You could take a picture of it, send it in, apply for a patent, and you would get a patent. And, of course, you can go back and put the lid back on and boil it and get another set of instructions for making a different sort of functional device. And I tell the story sort of tongue-in-cheek, knowing that the reader, as the reader reads this, they're going to know that this is nonsense, that this can't happen. But then I say, how is it that we know that this can't happen, and why can't it happen? So it becomes a device that I use throughout the book, referring back to it and saying, look, we all know there are certain things that can't happen. Let's see if we can figure out why they can't happen. And if Oracle soup can't be possible, then how can the primordial soup that Darwin hypothesized, how can that story be true and the Oracle soup story be false? So that's how I use the device.
Yeah, and I think it's very effective because I think, you know that intuition is pretty strong once we even see examples like that, and I think your illustration of Oracle soup really kind of draws that out. You know, a lot of people sometimes will kind of raise the issue, well, look, chance, time, all those kinds of things, and you've obviously done a ton of work and research in the lab on proteins, but maybe what is a protein? Let's start there, and then what is the probability of coming up with just one protein fold by accident? Like, I think you've done some work on that and some calculations around it, but I think that'd be fascinating for
sure.
Audience to kind of unpack.
Okay, so we're most familiar with protein as just a component of our diet. We have to get, you know, carbohydrate and protein and fats. And the reason we need to have protein in our diet is we need to, our bodies digest these proteins to get the amino acids from them. So proteins are long chain molecules that are built, it's like stringing beads on a string. And there are 20 different kinds of these beads that are called amino acids. They have different shapes and different chemical properties. We need all 20 of those for our cells to build proteins. And basically all of the functions within a cell at the subcellular level are orchestrated by these protein chains that fold up and form precise three-dimensional structures and become parts of machines, or they become little chemical factories that make and break down chemicals. They do all the little teeny work at the molecular level that makes cells work. And the interesting thing, the connection to evolution, is all forms of life need thousands of these of different kinds, and the sequence of amino acids along these chains turns out to be critical for specifying their three-dimensional folded structures. If you mess up that sequence, it doesn't fold at all. We can't go into the lab to this day. And when I say we, I mean no one can go into the lab and just write down a sequence or calculate a sequence that will fold to a new structure. We've been unable to solve this problem. So these are remarkable sequences of amino acids. They're encoded by genes, and every single one of them is needed by the hundreds, by the thousands, for any cell to exist, to live. So the question is, where do you get the information for these genes? And that's the thing that I've been studying for a long time and doing tests to see, how critical are these sequences? How easily are they broken? And how likely is it that a random walk, that an accidental process would stumble upon one of them?
Yeah, and I think, you know, from studying your work, I mean, the probability is not good, right? I mean, it's not as though...
It's not good.
that would be the understatement of the year, probably.
To quote a Jim Carrey movie, or like one in a million. So there is a chance, but this is not one in a million. This is one in a trillion, 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 trillion is roughly the odds of accidentally stumbling upon one functional sequence, which is, once you get into odds that are that ugly, like one in 10 to the 50, one in 10 to the 60, and if you're not familiar with scientific notation, 10 to the 50 is one with 50 zeros after it, which is a very large number. You'd have to have more than that number of attempts at more than that number of random sequence attempts in order to stumble upon one that works. And it turns out that once you get up to numbers that are that large, there just haven't been enough living things on Earth, even over the billions of years that life has existed, in order for something like that to have happened.
Yeah, so no matter the time scale, the accident appeals to chance. Almost, you know, sometimes when I see this online or interact with other literature, it's almost people kind of personify chance as if it's this thing or this person, this agent,
yeah,
who's acting, you know, kind of arranging the combinations or different things like that. But that's not really what's happening, is it?
No. And, yeah, I think there's a tendency in evolutionary circles to think of natural selection as really being like these human breeders knowing what it wants to do, carefully crafting things. When you get down to the real theory, what it actually states there is no careful crafting. There can't be if it's an entirely accidental process, and the numbers just don't work. You can't get remarkable things by accident, and that's an intuition that is solid.
Yeah, and so it's empirically confirmed as well as being a
correct
strong intuition. I love
yep
it. The another illustration that I found was helpful, I thought might be a great mental hook. And again, I'm talking today to Dr. Douglas Axe. He's author of the great book, Undeniable, How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life is Designed. Just a really great and accessible introduction into a very powerful case for a designer, in my opinion. And so you kind of raised the issue or kind of the illustration of the magician's hat to kind of help explain some concepts and test them. How would you use that to kind of show kind of what's going on as you do your work and other scientists do their work of explanations?
Well, I do this to help people. I'm aware that there are all kinds of technical claims. So a newspaper article will come out and say, so-and-so at this university did something that shows evolution can create new life or something like that. And I realize that if you're not a scientist, you don't know what to make of these articles. And most people won't go from the New York Times article and go dig out the actual scientific literature to see what was done. And if you did get a copy of that paper, most people wouldn't be able to read them. So it's all sort of technical mumbo-jumbo. I introduced the magician's hat for people who aren't scientists to discern what's even relevant to the argument. What I'm basically saying in the book is the claim that accidental causes can generate life forms is equivalent to a claim of magic by accident. So accidental causes cannot invent things. Life is not just an invention, but it's a remarkably brilliant invention. So the claim that things like dragonflies and, you know, palm trees could come about by accident is equivalent to a claim of magic. So if someone is saying they've shown that this works, I'm saying test it by that criterion. Does what they've actually shown, does it actually look like magic? And so the way you do this, you say, what went in, what sort of resources, including expertise and human help, went into this project that's just been described, and what came out? And does it look like magic when you consider what went into it? Invariably, when you look at these projects that way, there's an example where a team of three or four people claim that an evolutionary process produced a simple computational function. Well, you have two or three computer science experts who went into the project who easily could code up the function that came out, and what comes out is therefore not at all magic compared to what went in. Or you take an older example, Richard Dawkins, his book, The Blind Watchmaker. He takes random character strings, he does an evolutionary process on them, and out pops a short line of Shakespeare. Well, what went into that project was Richard Dawkins and his computer. Richard Dawkins knows that line of Shakespeare. So what comes out, even if you don't consider the technical details of what he did, what comes out is not amazing when you consider what went into the project. Richard Dawkins knew the line, and he thinks that it's like a weasel. He comes out with that on his computer. Well, he could have just typed it. He could have done any of the number things, but it's not magic. So that's a simple way to show that what was demonstrated, what Dawkins demonstrated, what his other team demonstrated, is not what would have to be demonstrated in order for life to come about by accident. They're not amazing us with what they show us, and they would have to do that in order to be addressing the actual argument.
Yeah, that's a very helpful illustration, way to look at that. You know, as you've written a book and you've obviously made the argument that kind of builds on that universal design and intuition, what would you say are maybe the top one or two most powerful reasons that, in your opinion, the design intuition has really triumphed over Darwin's evolutionary story? Like, for you, what are the biggest ones?
Well, the two big ones that I focus on the book, one of them actually relates more directly to my 25 years of research in the area done with other people. And the other one really goes back to thinking I was having even as an undergraduate before I started doing this research. The one has to do with really the probabilities, these extraordinary improbabilities of the coincidence you would need for accidental processes to do something that looks brilliant. Accidental causes are not brilliant, they're stupid. So for a stupid process to do something that makes it look like a genius is a coincidence. And it's an extreme coincidence. You can put numbers on how extreme these are. That's the improbability of the thing happening by accident. When you do that, you get these scary numbers like the one in a trillion, 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 far worse than that. So it turns out that the numbers are so bad, it can't happen. And that's kind of the main argument of the book, is once things become improbable to an extreme degree, I call them fantastically improbable, you might as well just call them impossible because they're never going to happen. The second argument, which is really entirely different, categorically different, but in my mind is as powerful, and for some people it might even be more powerful, is it's the same argument that Thomas Nagel, who's an atheist philosopher of mind, put forward in his book, Mind and Cosmos, why the materialist neo-Darwinian conception of nature is almost certainly false. As an atheist philosopher of mind, he says there's no way that accidental physical processes, that atoms and molecules, matter and energy, can conspire to produce conscious mind. So the very thing that we're doing when we think, when we reason, that can't happen just from physical substance. There has to be a conceptual realm. There has to be a realm of mind that allows thought to happen. And that, I think, and he, I think he's absolutely right, and he's very bold as an atheist to make this claim, and he's been attacked for making it.
Yeah.
But I think that's actually, it's a completely different, separate argument, and it's as powerful or more powerful in showing that there's no way that creatures like us could have come about from any material process whatsoever, because we're not entirely material. Our bodies are material, but our minds can't be explained in terms of material process.
Yeah, you know, because, you know, you almost get the sense sometimes that people think, well, look, if all we are purely physical objects, you know, reality is ultimately a series of BBs or Legos, physical things, just rearranging them into more and more complex patterns isn't going to get you anything immaterial, no matter how long you do it.
Correct.
And so I think that's a very powerful argument to bring up as well. You know, and so I guess my question, I was going to ask this a little bit later, but if, you know, as you know, Nagel and others are starting to say, is that there's the neo-Darwinian synthesis is failing in some ways, those who are
right.
What are the theories that are out there? I've come across, you know, different people, you know, evolution 2.0 or different, like, what are the different, if it can't be the classic neo-Darwinism, where's the conversation heading now?
Well, so you might say there's the academic preference would be to patch it. If there's a leak in the Darwinian life raft, they want to find a way to patch it, not a way to replace it, or not a way to let it sink. They don't like intelligent design. By they, I mean the scientific establishment. So they're desperate for a way to make this thing continue to work and hobble along. And it's interesting because so many bright naturalist-leaning scientists, so people who aren't wanting to let God into the equation, so many of these people are recognizing that the Darwinian theory does not work. I was at a conference in London in early November. It was organized by the Royal Society, the British Royal Society, so very prestigious organization, put together a conference called New Trends in Evolutionary Biology, and it brought together a whole bunch of people who are not content with Darwinism, but they can't stand intelligent design, and they're trying to think of what's called a third way. Give us some way to solve this problem, these huge problems with Darwinism, that doesn't require us to believe in God. That's really what they want. And it was interesting. They don't have the answer. There's all kinds of infighting and bickering as to who should get credit for what and whether natural selection is the main thing or whether there are other things, but none of them are addressing the big elephant in the room, which is that none of these accidental processes can do anything like inventing something clever, and life is far beyond clever. It's absolutely brilliant. So they don't know where to go with it, but they know where they don't want to go. I think that's the answer.
So it's like, well, we know who didn't do it, so let's make
it. Yeah, right. We insist it's not God. But we haven't figured out what the answer is.
Yeah, no, that's really fascinating. Yeah, because I guess one of the main counterarguments that Darwin evolutionary theory will kind of throw towards those who hold intelligent design or something like that, well, it's just not science, something like that. But You actually advocate in the book for something called open science. Can you unpack a little bit of that and kind of also deflect a little bit of that criticism that's so commonly thrown against people who kind of would say, no, we can discover design in our world?
Sure. So I connect really common science and open science. So this idea, what I'm really against is an elitist notion of science where the, you know, people in the top research universities who are teaching the scientific discipline, those are the ones who can tell us what's true or false about the physical universe. And, oh, by the way, there isn't anything but the physical universe. So basically, these people are saying, we are the ultimate authorities who tell human beings what is true about reality. Okay, and that's a pretty big... to make that claim is to claim that you are the owners of truth, period. What I'm arguing is that since we all are participants in this exercise called science, if you include common science, and I argue that it fundamentally is science, so we're all observing this world together, and we're all making models about what works, then we should have a much more inclusive view of what qualifies as science. So I'm calling that open science. Science ought to be open to everyone who is observing and everyone who is using common sense to figure out how things work. It shouldn't be this exclusive elitist game. And so then at the end of the book, chapter 14, I have a chapter that's called The New School. I'm arguing that, so this is an answer to the question of a critique that's made that once you go intelligent design, you're basically stopping science, or it's not science, or it's a science stopper. I'm arguing really the opposite, that we have not yet seen the life sciences flourish in a way that they would flourish if we allowed, if we freed thinkers to think radically about life. And that means if we freed them to think about design as being real, not illusory, if we freed them to connect biology to the engineering disciplines by radically understanding life as an engineered, but an artistically and brilliantly engineered thing, that living things look like inventions because they are inventions. So I'm arguing that we would open the door to a completely new way of doing the life sciences, and it would have to be a productive, highly productive way of doing the life sciences if we were to allow design to be a part of the way we think about life. And there are specific examples of interesting questions that should have been pursued that weren't pursued under the current Darwinian thinking. Most of us heard the term junk DNA, for example. If you think back to the Human Genome Project era, so the early 2000s when we were first publishing these large genomes, it was claimed that a big chunk of them, like 96% of our genome, is junk DNA. That's the term that used to be used. We now know that that's completely false, that although it's a small fraction of our genome that seems to be encoding proteins, there is definitely a role, a functional role for the whole genome, and that's become clear. So people have thrown away this term junk DNA. But we never, how did we get there in the first place? The way people were thinking was, if our DNA evolved from, if we evolved from bacteria and it was an accidental process, then you would expect that most of this DNA is not sensible writing, it's not sensible code, it's just junk, and out of the junk somehow emerge some functional things. That's how they were thinking as Darwinists. And I think the new school would have approached that very differently, assuming that our entire genome is brilliantly crafted, that there is something to be found there. There's a reason things are the way they are. It's not just cobbled together by accident.
I think it's fascinating. You know, you were talking about going to London at that conference. Did you get a sense that there's any more of an awareness among people about their philosophical kind of presuppositions on some of those questions? It's like that the presupposing materialism or naturalism is the only way?
Not really. I mean, I think for the most part, scientists are not philosophically astute. They can make some pretty glaring philosophical errors and be unaware of it. They don't seem to be self-aware when it comes to assumptions and worldviews. They assume that the way they think is just right. So it's not a philosophically sophisticated crowd by and large. And at that meeting, there were these, one of the talks, in fact, was about the use of design language and purpose language in the life sciences. The person giving the talk was not wanting to take intelligent design seriously, but was simply saying that if we take design as a metaphor, we find that the terminology, the words that are used by engineers and by design people, they work well in the life sciences, so let's go ahead and use them. And this guy specifically said, I'm not saying this is true, it's false, and he trashed ID, but he said, we should feel free to use these terms. Well, the reaction to that talk, even though he so clearly bashed intelligent design in the talk, there was fireworks afterward because some people were saying, even using that terminology, what you're saying is bothersome. So we were not among, when I say we, there were several other people who are advocates of intelligent design who were at the London meeting. We were not giving talks. We were just there to listen. And the design perspective was definitely not held up as a serious option at the meeting.
Yeah, that's just fascinating. You know, just kind of coming full circle, I think one of the things you say in your book, you kind of as the starting point, is to what or to whom do we owe our existence? This has to be the starting point for taking life seriously. Why do you think it really comes down to that as a starting point question?
Well, where we came from, I say all through the beginning, has everything to do with who we are, and who we are has everything to do with how we live our lives. I mean, ultimately, whether you spend time seriously wrestling with these issues or not, we humans come to an understanding of who we are, and that really becomes the dominant factor in deciding how we should live our lives. If we see ourselves as the handiwork of God, made in the image of God, we will view Scripture one way, and we will view the impact of Scripture and the will of God on our lives one way. If we come to see ourselves as cosmic accidents, you know, products of the primordial soup, we will view ourselves another way, and we will view Scripture another way, and we will likely live a very different life. So I think all of the things that go wrong with human thinking go wrong because we have a wrong view of who we are, and that traces back to where we came from. So I think it's among the most important questions.
Yeah, I completely agree. You know, here at Impact 360 Institute, we get to work with a lot of students, a lot of young people. We have a 9-month gap year for high school graduates, and we have 2-week worldview and leadership programs in the summer called Immersion. We're helping students think through these kind of questions, like who am I and why am I here? But some of them are inclined to go into the scientific fields and areas, but sometimes they're nervous about doing that. Maybe as a scientist who's practiced for the past 25 years, give some young Christians some encouragement about some tips about how they ought to go about that if they find themselves passionate about the sciences and what a career or a vocation in that area might look like.
Sure, and I am one of those, so I was there, and I would just really encourage people who have that gifting and that interest to pursue that gifting and to pursue the sciences. What I would say is be careful not to make yourself a figure of controversy too early. So study in your discipline, if you're studying physics or biochemistry or whatever you're studying, study well, get good grades, get your credentials, and then look for the place where you can go in and make a difference. And don't make the mistake of, as an undergraduate, starting a controversial movement on campus and, you know, challenging your professors, because then you probably won't get the PhD. It is a seriously flawed system, the educational system, and there is retribution. There are blacklists. Professors will make it hard for students who they see as being anti-scientific, and there is this view that Christianity or anyone who has any qualms about signing up to a full-blown Darwinian view of life is somehow anti-science. Of course, it's not anti-science, but that's the view out there. So students can get themselves, they can harm their own progress by becoming champions of design too early. So I would say keep your powder dry, get your education completed, get your credentials, and be praying all along about where the Lord might use you and use your gifting to make a difference. But don't do things that are too controversial too early.
Well, Well, I think that's excellent advice, and really appreciate you sharing that with our audience. Our guest today has been Dr. Douglas Axe, author of the book Undeniable, How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life is Designed. Just highly recommend this book, very accessible, will help you kind of understand the nature of the debate and also make the case for design as well. So if you're listening and want to encourage you to definitely, you can find links to that at our website, impact360.org. We'll have links to more about Dr. Axe and his work, as well as how you can find that book. But Doug, I just want to thank you for taking the time and just your hard work in this area that you've been able to share with us today.
Oh, it's been great to be with you.
For more information about our on-campus worldview and leadership experiences for students and our accessible online courses like Explore Truth and Explore the Resurrection, visit impact360.org. Impact 360 Institute. Know. Be. Live.